Japan is doing everything in its power to create the illusion that the Fukushima area is safe, recovering, even recovered. Anything to make it look well on the road to normal in time for you to book your flights and hotel rooms for the 2020 Tokyo Olympics. But then, someone who knows the area, speaks fluent Japanese, and is aware of the wide range of nuclear dangers posed in the area, goes on the ground for 4 days to find out what's there, and she tells you,
generally, what we saw in the coastal towns of Hamadori today brought to my mind the Frankenstein monster. The government is putting on a show of resurrecting a being from a random collection of parts. They're stitching together so many different piecemeal ideas and ventures, and not one of them will successfully bring the area back to life.
Well, when you hear something like that from someone who is there, a former journalist who saw it up close and personal and reports the truth of what she witnessed, you begin to understand more fully that you and I and everyone on Earth is in that awful seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as the survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, part two of an on-the-ground look at the current state of Fukushima Prefecture, 8.5 years after the triple nuclear meltdown happened there. Beverly Finlay Kaneko traveled through the prefecture for 4 days, going right to the edge of and sometimes through the evacuation zone, talking with activists and locals, finding out what the Japanese government is and isn't doing with the contaminated lands that will host the first 3 days of the Olympic torch run, baseball and women's softball games, and house athletes. This is a very human look at the ongoing devastation of the nuclear accident at Fukushima. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than is allowed to be mentioned around the Thanksgiving table I'll be sitting at on Thursday. All that coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, November 26, 2019, and here is the week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Focusing on Japan this week, where Fukushima wants to serve athletes at the 2020 Olympics, it's rice, fruits, beef, and vegetables. It's part of an ongoing campaign to convince people that everything from Fukushima is normalized and A-OK. For example, Japan allows a maximum of 100 becquerels of cesium radioactivity per kilogram of food, and proudly proclaims that 9.21 million bags of rice were examined in 2018, and not a single one exceeded this Japanese limit. However, Nuclear Hot Seat contacts in Japan say that Fukushima rice is routinely mixed with rice from other prefectures so that positive contamination levels are seen to be lower on a per-bag basis. This concern was also discussed in last week's Nuclear Hot Seat number 439 in the interview with Beverly Finlay Kaneko. As it stands, many countries, including China, South Korea, Hong Kong, Macau, Taiwan, and Singapore, all continue to maintain bans on some or all of the food from Fukushima. And South Korea is bringing in all of the food to be fed to its athletes during the Olympics. Pope Francis, who has been visiting Japan, called out on Monday, November 25th, for renewed efforts to help victims of Japan's 2011 triple disaster, earthquake, tsunami, and Fukushima meltdown, noting concern in the country over the continued use of nuclear power. The Pope stopped just short of intervening in the debate over nuclear power in Japan, but noted that in 2016, the Catholic Bishops' Conference of Japan made a statement saying, "What Japan has experienced in the 5.5 years since the Fukushima disaster convinces us that we must inform the world of the hazards of nuclear power generation and appeal for its abolition." Which leads us to
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
And rounding out the Pope news, a Japanese Catholic from Fukushima Prefecture plans to present locally grown persimmons to Pope Francis during his visit to Japan. Chuichi Ozawa from Koriyama City, a member of the Koriyama Catholic Church, has proposed presenting Aizu Mishirazu persimmons to the Pope to help dispel concerns about the safety of Fukushima produce due to the accident. Ozawa says if the Pope eats the persimmons, it will lift the spirits of Fukushima farmers. However, none of these persimmon are reputed to have been tested for radiation contamination. So hey, Francis, listen up. This is a propaganda alert. They want to use you to give Fukushima produce a pass when it comes to being concerned about its safety. So please, don't fall for it. Do not be a propaganda tool after you've just said so many things that are important about nuclear. And know that if you do, you will fully qualify as this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment. But first, it's official. The holiday season is upon us. Time for me to share with you how thankful I am for your support of Nuclear Hot Seat throughout the years. It's very simple. Without the assistance of people like you to keep the show running, we could not keep going. Right now, the exciting news is that we're starting the website revamp, the goal being easier searchability, a great new look, and the capacity to keep uploading new episodes until the nuclear problem is solved or we reach the half-life of plutonium, whichever comes first. It is an important step for the show, and one that's been a long time coming. The problem is that it's going to be a major expense, well over and above regular operating costs, and we have to raise the money to cover it. Some of you have already provided financial support to go towards the new website, for which I'm deeply grateful, because that's what's allowing me to start the process. But we've still got a long way to go, and we'll need the help of a lot more of you to get this beautiful, more functional new website up and running. So if you're grateful for the kind of verifiable news you get here every week on nuclear issues around the world, please consider showing your gratitude with a donation. Any amount helps, be it a one-time donation to honor the holidays, monthly sustaining donations. It all helps to keep honest, verifiable nuclear information flowing out to you, the listeners. We make it easy to help. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the big red donate button. Know that whatever you can afford, you're helping to combat the nuclear menace in all its forms with solid, footnoted, reliably sourced information. That makes me deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Here's this week's featured interview. Last week, in Nuclear Hot Seat number 439, we spoke with Beverly Finlay Kaneko about the current status of Fukushima. Beverly lived in Yokohama, Japan for 20 years until March of 2011, after the Great Eastern Japan earthquake. She worked at Yokohama National University and the Japan Times. Beverly has a master's degree in East Asian Studies from Stanford University and speaks Japanese fluently. Since returning to the U.S. from Japan, Beverly and her husband, Yuji Kaneko, have been active in raising awareness about nuclear issues, including the massive nuclear accident at Fukushima. Their main activities have included organizing speaking tours, giving presentations, networking in activist and nuclear-impacted communities in the U.S. and Japan, and I'm happy to say, co-producing the annual Nuclear Hot Seat Voices from Japan special to commemorate the anniversary of the start of the Fukushima disaster. Recently, Beverly and Yuji spent 4 days in Fukushima Prefecture with local activists to find out what life is like for those who are still trying to live there, as well as those who will never return. This is not a technical report on the site itself, but an eyewitness recounting of the human factor, what the world's worst nuclear accident has done to the people and the land, and how Japanese officials are trying to cover it up. Part one of this interview, based on over 3 hours of conversation, ran in last week's Nuclear Hot Seat number 439. In today's part two, Beverly reveals pro-nuclear propaganda packaged as a very manipulative museum, takes us through dramatic changes in the towns of Tomioka, Aizu, and Namie, and brings us to within visual distance of Fukushima Daiichi itself. We pick up at the point where last week's interview ended.
You continued on to Tomioka. How close is Tomioka to Fukushima Daiichi?
Depending where you are in the town, it's around 4.5 miles away from Fukushima Daiichi. So it's very close. And that's where Kida-san used to live. So to get there, we drove through some tunnels and along the Tomioka River. We passed the Takigawa Dam. And as we passed that, Kida-san mentioned that Tomioka gets its drinking water from that river. And after the accident, she asked an expert, in quotes, about, you know, your so-called experts, right? About the safety of the town's water, because Fukushima's waterways were impossible to decontaminate and have been a pathway for further contamination due to runoff from the mountains and the forest. And she was told that cesium sinks to the bottom and drinking water comes from the top, so it's safe. But she didn't get an answer when she asked what happens when the water is stirred up during big storms and typhoons and so forth. It seems logical that much of that contamination has built up at the base of dams like Takigawa over the years.
But she didn't get an answer as to what that would mean.
No. To me, it means that if you were going to live there, you'd better have a good supply of bottled water from somewhere else. A couple minutes after that, there was a turn in the road, and we pulled over to the side, and Kida-san pointed through the trees at Fukushima Daiichi in the distance. So I actually saw the place with my very own eyes. It was there. It was just a few kilometers away.
Was there any particular warning, or were there barriers up, or was there any direct connection, or you just had a glimpse of it and then continued on?
We just had a glimpse and continued on. I think that if you didn't know it was there, you wouldn't know. But of course, they knew because they're from there, so they wanted to point it out to us. As we approached Tomioka, the landscape started changing quite a bit. So up until this point, we had lots of paddy fields and people who were still trying to make a go of it. However futile it was, they were still trying to do things. But toward Tomioka, there were more and more weed-choked paddy fields, and it just really spoke to the neglect over the past 8 years. Ironically, quite a few enterprising farmers have elected to cover their fields with solar panels and sell the electricity to TEPCO. Interestingly, some of the solar farms were erected on pillars, like you see here in Southern California in parking lots, so, you know, a car or something can get underneath. Kida-san told us that that's so that the aging farmers that own the land can get under there with a tractor and clean out the weeds every so often.
There's something so ironically perfect about Fukushima destroyed lands being used with solar panels and then selling the electricity to TEPCO.
Yeah, well, that's one of their big platforms in reconstruction. You know, one of the businesses that they're trying to foster is renewable energy and research. I think that that was a good thing, and it's too bad more of the places weren't covered with solar panels. Soon we arrived in Tomioka, and Tomioka is a former ghost town. It was reopened in April 2017 for repatriation. Yuji had been here before with Hida-san and Kida-san while this town was still in the exclusion zone. As a resident, Kida-san was able to enter for short visits to check on her home, but she couldn't stay overnight. At that time, all three of them wore protective clothing and masks, even inside Kida-san's home. And they were surprised by an Inobuta boar pig rooting around in the abandoned field across the street. On this trip, Tomioka gave the impression of a ghost town mixed with emergency department triage. The original population of 16,000 is only 1,000 after 2 years, and that number includes decontamination and reconstruction workers. During our time in the town, I saw very few personal vehicles and almost no regular people walking around. Almost everybody had a uniform on, from a police officer stationed at the Do Not Enter gate next to the exclusion zone, to pocket protector supporting engineers, to dozens and dozens of grubby construction workers. And aside from supermarket checkers, there were almost no women. The only child I saw, and this was really weird, was a little Caucasian boy there with his dad. Most of the houses were still empty, but there were some apartments that had men's laundry hanging on the balconies.
Were you able to get to Kida-san's former house?
Yes, and strangely enough, her house was occupied. She sold it cheaply a couple years ago to someone who gave her a story about having her own home destroyed in the earthquake and needing a new home. It was actually a scammer who was going around and buying up properties at fire sale prices from people who'd relocated. The house was remodeled inside and apparently sold to a company involved in reconstruction or decontamination, and it's now being used as a dorm. It seems so very odd to see that people were living in that house that just a few years ago was so contaminated that Kida-san, Hida-san, and Yuji had to wear protective gear and shoes indoors. We moved on from her house, got out and roamed around a little bit by the edge of the difficult to return zone, which was across the street from the area where it was okay for people to live.
That's amazing that it's like an invisible line down the middle of the street. It's like, well, you can't live over there, but you can live over here. But is there really any difference?
No, the radiation readings were the same on both sides of the street. It is really arbitrary. I think the main thing is there's a street there, and they have to have the streets open for the different trucks and things to get through. And so it's really, what does the map look like? What's the most convenient place to cut this off? It's really arbitrary. We saw an abandoned elementary school, and you know, even though there are no kids there, they still have the radiation monitor in the middle, seeing how much atmospheric radiation there was. And for good measure, its reading was below what Hida-san's monitor registered.
Of course.
So, Hida-san and Kida-san told us stories about homes and businesses being looted due to lack security in the exclusion zone. They were always spooked when they were visiting because of the threat of unwelcome visitors. We strolled by a bamboo grove across from Kida-san's house, and she mentioned that 1 year thieves had come out in the spring and dug up all the contaminated bamboo shoots to sell on the black market. So don't buy things from the roadside stands.
Isn't that supposed to be lucky bamboo, which is how it's sold?
Yeah, luck of the draw, I guess. So we drove to another part of the town where a lot of reconstruction and a lot of new development has been taking place. And one of the big projects was called the Sakura Mall, which is really just a grocery store and some services attached. Again, there was the PR section with the racks of PR material promoting the town to people who might want to move there or people who might want to visit.
And again, Tomioka is how close to Fukushima Daiichi?
About 4.5 miles away from Fukushima Daiichi.
What kind of PR were they putting out? What were they saying?
Well, one of the things was a $10,000 stipend for people that would move to Tomioka or various other municipalities in Fukushima and live there for 3 years or more. There was a big slick booklet that touted all the modern technological investments being made in the exclusion zone, a big robotics industry that's starting, decommissioning science industry, and they've even developed a drone that helps catch the ubiquitous Inobuta boar pigs. There was one cute pamphlet that advertised Tomioka's charms for tourists, but it was obvious that most of the photos were taken pre-disaster and only during special events. What is not being promoted to potential residents is that Tomioka is home to a huge permanent disposal site to bury radioactive waste that the government started building and using in November 2017. The landfill encompasses 23 acres, which is 18 football fields. This is where decontamination waste like straw, ash, sewage sludge, weeds, and so on that are between 8,000 becquerels per kilogram and 100,000 becquerels per kilogram will be stored for eternity.
I can understand why they wouldn't put that in any come on for people to move there.
Some of the other things we saw in the town included a brand new Japan Atomic Energy Agency collaborative laboratories for advanced decommissioning science. And on the other side of the street was a newly built medical clinic, and it had a helipad in the parking lot. A helipad seems so unnecessary in a little town with 1,000 residents, but if you think about the work that's being done 4.5 kilometers or 4.5 miles away, as well as the lack of actual working hospitals in the former exclusion zone, it makes sense. And we stopped for a few moments in the parking lot of a brand new, gigantic, fancy public library. There was a big sign advertising the Tokyo Olympics on the outside. Got to have people remember the central government as their benefactor. But instead of moms taking their kids in for story time, the only people going in and out were men in work clothes, perhaps to snooze for a while on their afternoon break, like so many zombies populating this nuclear ghost town.
You continued to travel through this area, and you were on Highway 6. What was it like traveling along that route?
Tomioka is on the south end of the exclusion zone, and Namie, which was our next stop, is on the north side. The only way we could get to Namie is to go straight through this difficult to return zone or the exclusion zone. We were on Route 6, which is a surface road, and it's east of the highway and closer to Fukushima Daiichi. At the entrance to the exclusion zone on the highway, there's a sign that orders you to stay in your car with the windows up. And there's a good reason for this, because inside the car, Hida-san's radiation monitor wavered between 2 and 3 microsieverts per hour for most of the ride. There was one gas station with a small rest stop along the way for people who have a serious mental block about planning ahead. I wonder about the people that work at that gas station. There are folding metal gates blocking all the roads that bisect Route 6 and all the entrances to parking lots so that curious people don't stray off the main drag. But given the amount of crime in the area, people do find their way into the exclusion zone at night, despite preventative measures.
What was it like being so close to the belly of the beast, being right there in and at the most dangerous part of the radioactive exclusion zone?
It was like a ride through Jurassic Park or the zombie apocalypse. Abandoned gas stations, restaurants, a home center covered with kudzu vines, pachinko parlors with no longer flashing neon lights. There was an idle rice mill. There were ramen shops with broken windows. there was a giant electronic store that had been slated to open just a few weeks after the accident. There were bags of contaminated soil strewn here and there for good measure. And there was a temple and a cemetery with gravestones that were decorated with fresh flowers for the fall equinox, reminding us that people do go in regularly to tend to the ancestors they had to leave behind. That was really sad. But overall, Route 6 was shocking. Even after seeing so many abandoned properties and deteriorating businesses still on display in Tomioka. Finally, we drove past the guards at the northern edge of the stretch and arrived in Namie, which is about 4 miles from Fukushima Daiichi.
Your destination was Namie, which is in what used to be the exclusion zone. Talk us through what that was like.
Well, we didn't actually visit any village part of Namie, but the portion that we did visit was very sobering. Looking up from the shore of the ocean, there was a large flat area covered with weeds that was punctuated in the middle with a stand of dead tree trunks where there used to be a town. That area was completely flattened by the tsunami. And beyond the site of the former town was a small hill with a monument to tsunami victims. And then above that, there was a cemetery. The people that were able to run up this hillside in time, including a group of school children, were able to escape the ocean's grasp. Many others perished. Kida-san explained to us that the grave markers in the cemetery that didn't have dates were for those people who were never found. It's really sad because Namie was in the exclusion zone. There were many bodies that were lost forever because nobody could go look for them. So we went and paid our respects at the monument and looked out across toward the ocean. Unfortunately, the view at this sacred site is marred by a giant incinerator in the distance and fields of bags full of decontamination debris waiting to be dealt with. We drove down the hill to get a closer look at this, and all of those ubiquitous bags were piled row upon row, several layers deep. I'm sure your listeners have seen a million pictures of the same thing. Bags toward the bottom of the pile and around the edges had burst and disintegrated. Their toxic contents were spilling and turning into mud in the light rain. Weeds poked out here and there. While lacking in the drama of bags rushing downstream during Typhoon Hagibis, I'm sure that this site and others like it filled with water too, washing contamination into the ocean and into the rivers, onto the land, to percolate down into the groundwater.
Given how desolate the landscape is by your description, do any people actually still live in Namie?
According to the Washington Post earlier this year, just 873 people, or under 5% of an original population of 17,613, have returned to Namie. Kida-san and Hida-san estimate that it's really only about 500 returnees because the government always adds decontamination workers to the mix. They told us that there is no post office in Namie yet, but the Washington Post notes that there's a brand new school with only 5 students enrolled.
Again, Japanese tax dollars at work.
So that's about all we saw in Namie. Generally, what we saw in the coastal towns of Hamadori today brought to my mind the Frankenstein monster. The government is putting on a show of resurrecting a being from a random collection of parts. They're stitching together so many different piecemeal ideas and ventures, and not one of them will successfully bring the area back to life. But perhaps their end is in the effort alone. And the real story lies somewhere in the 23-acre radioactive landfill in Tomioka. The government may be enlisting mayors, council members, and would-be businessmen to be cheerleaders for reconstruction, but their goal is probably not restoring the lives of the former residents that they'd really rather have disappear from the equation.
Your next stop was Miharu, and you had a very interesting trip to a museum there. Tell us about it.
We visited a museum called Komutan, or the Center for Environmental Communication Building. Its goal is to allow children and people in Fukushima to talk and think about the future of Fukushima. And that's actually on the Komutan English language pamphlet that they have being distributed there. It's a really high budget museum and exhibition space about the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster, radiation, and environmental protection. Children from all over Fukushima comprise the main visitors to the space. And this particular morning, we ran into two groups of fifth graders from different parts of the prefecture. There was also a prefectural international relations coordinator. He was a young guy from New Zealand, and he was escorting a couple of teachers from New Zealand around the space. I have to admit that a lot of it is really well done, and I think even us nuclear activists would learn a lot from the many exhibits. It's engaging, it's fun, there are interactive exhibits, there are colorful displays, and there's computer games, and it makes it a really entertaining space. There's even a cool radiation cloud chamber so kids can visualize actual ionizing radiation. It would be a really terrific asset to a teacher who guides her students with critical thinking activities after their visit there. Unfortunately, this is not what we witnessed on the day that we visited. Both groups were ushered through the museum by guides. The teachers remained quiet at the back, and none of the kids asked any questions. As a former teacher myself, I actually felt a little awkward lurking around the edges and eavesdropping, especially with Yuji and Hida-san simultaneously grumbling and taking pictures of the kids. First, the kids watched a film about the nuclear accident in a space that was surrounded with enlarged newspaper front pages from the time of the accident. The kids that day, they were probably about 3 years old when the accident happened, and probably none of them have any memories of what happened. For them, it's a history lesson. There's no grounding in reality, except for maybe the periodic thyroid screenings that they all have to undergo. I don't know if they connect that at all. After the film, they're ushered to a big model of the accident site, and that was really amazing in its detail. The guide, who was an older gentleman that had a really appealing storyteller style, did a really great job of simply explaining how and why the accident happened and what the result was. After the history lesson, the guide took the children to the radiation lab area and the environment of Fukushima Now section. The radiation lab has all kinds of goodies like the cloud chamber and radiation monitors, and the guide gave a really good explanation of the types of radiation. I really had no problem at all with what he was saying until he asked everyone, who eats healthy food, to raise their hands? And then everyone, who plays and gets a lot of exercise, to raise theirs? And everyone who gets a good night's sleep, to raise theirs? All the kids' hands popped up and they said hi in unison to each question. Good, said the guide. People who lead a healthy lifestyle are not affected by radiation.
Did you pop off at all when you heard this? Did you have any reaction that others could note?
I think my jaw dropped and I had to walk away and go and look at something else. I had heard about this kind of thing happening, but to actually see it happen in front of my very eyes, it was just unbelievable.
And of course, there was no contradictory voice coming out to tell
the kids. No, not at all. Other things that were in the space were an interactive map where kids could compare real-time radiation readings from various areas from now with those of April 2012. Of course, all the readings on the map were from rigged government monitors, So there's no discussion of the elevated radiation levels at the time of the accident. Radiation is being presented that something around us all the time, and the overall impression that was given is that it's something that's under human control. The guide showed the group of children from Iwaki now, and Iwaki in 2012, and then just efficiently ushered them to the next exhibit. Curious fingers weren't encouraged to try out Namie or Tomioka, for example. And note that Iwaki was one of the less contaminated areas, and it actually hosted a vast number of nuclear refugees. I think it hosted the most nuclear refugees of all. It's south, one of the furthest south towns along the coastline, one of the lower areas of radiation. But then again, it hosted so many refugees. And as an American with this sort of egalitarian, idealistic point of view, I would think it would be a really important lesson for the kids to understand why there are so many outsiders living in their town in order to stem the prejudice and discrimination that many of the people that evacuated to Iwaki have had to endure over these past 8 years. Forget about the radiation part. Let's talk about how we treat the refugees that are actually in our midst. And that lesson wasn't even there. While we're on the topic of maps, there's really a disturbing trend in Fukushima PR materials that hints toward the disappearing of towns in the exclusion zone. An English brochure from Komutan on quote-unquote eliminating the negative reputation impact is a good example. There's a map of Fukushima Prefecture with various towns and their radiation levels highlighted. None of those towns are the ones that were in the exclusion zone or adjacent to the exclusion zone. It's as if those places simply never existed. And of course, there's also a superimposed world map to show how much more radioactive other cities in the world are. And Seoul, Korea, is shown to be even more radioactive than anywhere in Fukushima. Koreans are always a special target of scorn in Japan. Yuji found it very disappointing that in addition to the lack of honest discussion about radiation levels and their meaning in terms of the accident, that the kids were ushered away from the decontamination lab, which actually had many details about the efforts being made to clean up the environment. It was all there for them to see. But why worry their little minds with the fact that radiation is not our friend and that we have to clean it up and put it away for a very, very long time?
The programmed ignorance is staggering. There is such an intentional and malign thinking behind this to steer people completely away, especially children, completely away from the truth about Fukushima. And of course, they say history is always written by the winners. And so it sounds like the government of Japan, TEPCO, Dentsu, the PR agency, they're rewriting the history of Fukushima to make it no big deal.
Right. So I had an interesting encounter on my way out of the museum. There was a young female tour guide that I had a chance to talk to. I asked her where the kids were visiting from that day, and then asked if there's a different understanding depending on where visitors have come from in the prefecture. She said that people from Hama and Nakadori are closer and more sensitive than the groups from Aizu, for example. People from Aizu see it as somebody else's problem. She told me that she's from Koriyama, and she has a little 3-year-old daughter at home. She said she worked at a department store at the time of the earthquake and had to help shoppers shelter and stay safe, and that she'd been involved with nuclear refugees from the towns around the plant. I asked her how it was having a small child in Fukushima, and she told me that she manages because food products from all over Japan are available, so she doesn't have to feed her little girl things she doesn't trust. She's actually not feeding her child food from Fukushima while she can prevent that from being done. She was very reasonable and realistic about the situation. I got a feeling that there was a little bit of honne and tatemae at work. And these words in Japanese are the actual truth is honne, the truth inside your heart. And the tatemae is the truth that's meant for public consumption. I wondered, what is Fukushima's actual truth? Because this was a real gray zone. This was somebody who was working in this place that's kind of meant to educate the kids, but is doing such a job of whitewashing over it. And yet she goes home and she has all the struggles that any mother living there would have trying to raise a child in a contaminated environment. And she recognizes that. I really felt for her. I save my anger for the prefectural international relations coordinator that was guiding the two teachers from New Zealand. He was all dressed up in a snazzy Fukushima prefecture logo emblazoned polo shirt. He obviously wasn't taking them around to the kinds of places we had visited. Rather, he was feeding them the prefectural government propaganda and sending them home to regurgitate it to their students back in New Zealand. The coordinator himself was young, probably in his mid-20s, and to give him a break, he was probably very naive, and he was very in love with his big adventure in Japan, copy editing propaganda and guiding around groups of foreigners to help polish Fukushima's image in the world's eye.
The last stop on your trip in Fukushima Prefecture was Aizu.
Aizu is on the far western side of the prefecture, and we were there to visit Chikako Chiba. She was one of our guests on Nuclear Hot Seat Voices from Japan 2018 thyroid cancer special. She directs the Ajisai no Kai support group for thyroid cancer victims. Her husband was a regional representative in the government until he retired, and Chiba-san herself has run for office on an anti-nuclear platform. They also have a nonprofit to help disabled people. So the two of them are no strangers to public service, and they know their way around government and bureaucracy. This is an important thing. On its surface, Ajisai no Kai is a support group for families affected by thyroid cancer. It's a chance for the families to compare notes with others in the same situation and for moms and kids to shore each other up. They gather occasionally in Chiba-san's large and warm living room to do crafts like flower art and just to relax. Chiba-san told us of a little girl who was going to have surgery soon and how an older girl reassured her by pulling away the neckline of her blouse and showing her her scar and saying, "Don't worry, I have one too. You're going to be just like me."
Oh.
Yeah. At least it helps to know somebody, you know, that you've been playing with has gone through it and you're going to come out okay on the other end.
Right. But what a sad thing for children to have to do for each other.
Yeah, exactly. Chiba-san's service goes further than just the get-togethers, though. She helps moms approach the prefectural government with problems, and she also does speaking engagements to raise awareness. She advocates for better treatment for victims. I kind of think of her as a little bit of an Aaron Barakovich type. The trouble is that even with the number of thyroid cancer patients found by the government screening survey reaching 273 as of last year, the government keeps insisting that there's no connection with the nuclear accident.
We covered many of these same arguments in Nuclear Hot Seat number 350. Which aired on March 6th of 2018.
That'll give you all the details if you wanted to listen to that. With another 18 patients recently documented by the 311 Fund for Children with Thyroid Cancer just this year, the total is now 291 known cases in Fukushima. The children uncovered by the 311 Fund demonstrate a big problem that's engineered into the Fukushima Prefecture Health Survey. Some families go for treatment outside the auspices of the survey, and they're not counted. They seek treatment through national health insurance at hospitals of their own choice. And sometimes it's precisely because they've sought second opinions from doctors unrelated to the Fukushima Medical University and the health survey, because they didn't actually trust the results. Another problem with the survey is that children who are classified for further observation are siphoned off to outside hospitals and dropped from the survey altogether. Chiba-san told us that the number of quote-unquote further observation children has reached 3,500. And if they do finally receive a cancer diagnosis, they will not be counted in Fukushima's total.
That's so unfair.
Yes, it's disappearing people again. So the potential cancer victims have been disappeared from the picture of the health effects of the nuclear accident on children's health. And everybody is touting this as the study with all of the empirical evidence that we need to show the whole situation, when it's actually just completely erasing a huge part of the picture. The purposeful improper tracking of thyroid cancer does more than downplay the statistics. It's a very real problem for parents seeking treatment for their kids, and for young adults who may develop the disease later or have to deal with the ongoing effects of being a cancer survivor. It places the burden of care for a disease caused by a corporation and the government on the victim and his or her family. Chiba-san said that the paperwork and red tape faced by these families is horrendous. Sometimes the prefecture denies treatment ordered by doctors outside the parameters of the survey, all while they force the further observation patients to find outside medical care. This seems particularly unfair because Japan has a system of quote-unquote benefit notebooks for various medical issues and disabilities. So in Japanese, they're called techo, and techo is kind of a notebook or a little folder. So, for example, there's a mother-child notebook called a boshi techo for newly pregnant mothers and their babies, and it has coupons for vaccinations and checkups, and there's places where the doctors can keep your vaccination schedule and keep track of things in there. There's a disabled person's notebook that has various benefits like discounted highway tolls and train fares for the handicapped. There's a hibakusha notebook for victims of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki atomic blasts. So those people have always had their care tracked in these notebooks. And there's also an evacuee's pass with perks for people that had to abandon their homes in the Fukushima exclusion zone. But there's no such thing for the thyroid cancer victims. So they've got everything, and it's just up to them to keep track. Chiba-san often goes to the prefecture to back up young mothers dealing with the unthinkable in a society that looks down on people that push back. She helps them advocate for themselves. She encouraged one frustrated mother recently to put her thoughts in a letter to the prefecture. Her child was in the 9th grade at the time of the accident, so she's a young adult now. The prefectural officer that received the letter said that it was the very first one that they'd ever received. Chiba-san allowed me to translate the letter and share it with the listeners of Nuclear Hot Seat. So here's what the mother wrote. It has been 8 years since the disaster. Everywhere you look, the catchphrase is reconstruction. But at our house, we still cannot see the future because we are battling with uncertainty. My child was diagnosed with thyroid cancer by the prefectural health survey, and the whole thyroid was removed. Even so, the condition remains the same. Every 3 months, we go to Fukushima Prefectural Medical University for blood tests. And every time we get our hopes up a tiny bit, only to be crushed by the results. We feel betrayed and come home in a depressed state. On top of the emotional damage we have sustained, the convoluted nature of the medical support system is a huge struggle in itself. Every time we receive treatment, we have to save the receipts and doctor's visit forms just in case we need them to get approval from the Fukushima Prefectural Medical University for treatment. All of this takes time. We have to provide copies of all receipts and forms. And if there's any small detail amiss, we spend hours on the phone trying to sort things out. Keeping records is so much of a hassle. Something like a booklet system would be extremely helpful. Right now, I'm still helping my child with record keeping, but I think in the near future, as a young adult, my child will probably not continue to keep proper records because it's such a hassle. I strongly hope that you'll consider making it easier to deal with the paperwork. Furthermore, there are many people who complain loudly about the disadvantages of the prefectural health survey. There are no disadvantages to continuing the survey. Rather, it would be much worse not to discover cancer until its later stages. There's the idea that thyroid cancer isn't fatal and that it's a mild form of cancer. But the people that say that obviously don't understand what it's like to have cancer. Even if it's not life-threatening, after surgery, one suffers many periods of ill health. Also, one's immune system doesn't function properly. I wish people would stop playing down the effects of thyroid cancer. Thank you for your time.
Such a polite letter for such a devastating situation. So having come through such an intense journey over the 4 days that you were traveling up to and through Fukushima Prefecture, what do you come away with?
I felt that Fukushima is a study in contrasts and contradictions. More than once, I felt my hardened anti-nuclear activist views being challenged by what we saw and the people we talked to. We were able to see the government's push to rebuild, repopulate, and revitalize areas that probably should never have been reopened and actually weren't in equally contaminated areas in Chernobyl. We were able to see earnest attempts on the part of people who have returned to their villages to bring their villages back to life. There was both black and white, but there were many gray areas, making it really hard to be judgmental. But the sheer magnitude of the problem hit me in a way that hasn't in the past, whether on my own trip to Fukushima City a few years ago, or in conversation with my husband, friends from Fukushima, or fellow activists. The money, the effort, the waste, and the destruction spreads across a large area. The accident site is like a cancer that has metastasized across Fukushima's topography, resisting attempts to resuscitate the surrounding villages and restore them to their former condition.
Beverly, this has been the equivalent of being on tour with you through Fukushima to see it in such detail and so close to the ground, which is where the truth actually lives.
Yes, well, I hope someday you will come with me on tour to Fukushima.
We'll discuss that off interview.
Okay.
But for now, Beverly Finlay Kaneko, the work you've done, the clarity you bring, and the joy I have in working with you as a collaborator to bring forth the truth of what's happening in Japan and especially for the people in and around Fukushima. I want to thank you for being my guest again this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you very much. And thank you so much for always letting these voices be heard, the ones that normally wouldn't be heard in an English-speaking environment. We really appreciate it.
Beverly Finlay Kaneko, reporting on her recent journey to and through Fukushima Prefecture. Photos taken by her husband, Yuji Kaneko, are on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 440. And last week's episode, the start of this interview, in episode number 339. Here's today's final thought, and it's taken from a post that I caught online that says much about the background of this week's holiday in the United States and some thoughts that Native people would like us to have while we are eating our turkey or tofurkey. It wrote, "It is said that history is written by the victors. And so we come to the annual American holiday of Thanksgiving. As many prepare for a day shared with family and friends, please understand that it is a day of grief for Native Americans. Thanksgiving is a brutal reminder of the genocide of millions of Native people, the theft of Native lands, and the relentless assault on Native culture. If you are truly grateful for your presence on our beautiful Turtle Island, recognize that it came with an enormous price and the near genocide of those who welcomed you here. In the memory of all those who died, honor their descendants and give prayers with apologies and compassion. Most of all, help stop pollution and take care of our Mother Earth so we may all live in a good way. To which I can only add, to honor the planet and the people, Native and otherwise, in this country and all others, please work to stop nuclear in all of its forms. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, November 26, 2019. A reminder that Nuclear Hot Seat is now available on all of your favorite podcast platforms. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe. And if you would like a guaranteed way of getting the show every week, go to the website, nuclearhotseat.com, scroll down to the yellow box, and fill it out. It's just going to ask for your first name and your email address. And what that will do is put you on the database to receive one email a week. I don't bug you. Just one. And that will have the link to each week's episode and a short description of some of what's in it. Now, this is mostly a one-woman band over here. So if you've got a story lead, a hot tip, or you know of something that I should be covering, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com with that information. And know that I'm open to others working with the show and coming up with stories in their own communities that we can carry on air. So if you would like to be an internet reporter and come up with a story that we can possibly use, again, email me. Let's talk. I'm always open to including other people in the flow of information so that we can be as up-to-date and as clear as possible. And if you appreciate weekly verifiable news updates about nuclear issues around the world, take a moment to send a donation of any size to nuclearhotseat.com. We will really be grateful for your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2019, Libby, Halevi, and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as proper attribution is provided. This is Libby Halevi of Hardestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that propaganda that minimizes nuclear radiation impact is meant to make you feel safe. But words don't change scientific facts. And when the words try to take you off your nuclear awareness, they just expose you to dangers that you cannot escape. There you've got it. You have just had your nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Question everything. Intelligent radio for intelligent people. UCY.TV.